This is Radio Boston. I'm Maria Garcia. We start today with the passing of George H.W. Bush, the 41st President of the United States. Bush passed away late Friday night at the age of 94. Here he is accepting the nomination for president at the 1988 Republican National Convention.
I fought for my country. I've served. I've built. And I'll go from the hills to the hollows, from the cities to the suburbs, to the loneliest town on the quietest street, to take our message of hope and growth for every American, to every American. I will keep America moving forward, always forward, for a better America, for an endless, enduring dream and 1,000 points of light. This is my mission, and I will complete it.
Bush's body will be arriving at the U.S. Capitol shortly, where he will lie in state in the rotunda until Wednesday morning. A memorial service is scheduled for Wednesday at 11 a.m. For more now on the life and legacy of President George H.W. Bush, we turn to David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and Pulitzer Prize-winning former politics correspondent for the Boston Globe. David, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And also with us is Boston College history professor Heather Cox Richardson, author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Welcome to Radio Boston.
It's always a pleasure.
Heather, we're going to bring you in just a minute, but I want to start with you, David. You wrote Bush's obituary for the Boston Globe, and you described him as a gifted foreign policy leader. Do you think that's his most lasting legacy in terms of his time as president?
Well, I would have thought so when he left office, that was probably his greatest asset. But I think his greatest legacy now is as a sentinel of a certain kind of civility and grace that is not present in our politics now, and that his death is a reminder of what we've lost. So, you know, there are plenty of public policy people and foreign policy people around. There aren't a lot of people with that inner grace. We know, of course, from Massachusetts that some of that grace was set aside in the 1988 campaign to beat Governor Dukakis. But nonetheless, I think his greatest legacy now is different from what we might have thought it would have been in 1993 when he left the White House.
I want to get back to that point. Heather, I want to jump to you. You know, there has been this outpouring of nostalgia for the more civil, gentle political approach that George H.W. Bush seemed to embody. Do you think that's a fair assessment of his approach?
I think it's fair to say that we are reaching back to that now, sort of in desperation because we feel it so far from us. But he's important domestically because he marked that bridge between the old Rockefeller Republicanism, Eisenhower Republicanism of his father, Prescott Bush, and the modern-day Republicanism of people like Newt Gingrich right up to the present with Donald Trump. He was really the bridge. If you remember, in 1980, he's the one who looked at Ronald Reagan and the rise of Ronald Reagan from the right and said that his economic policies were voodoo economics, and yet gradually was forced to capitulate to that vision of society to the point that he does embrace the Willie Horton ad, and he does put Dan Quayle, who had well-known connections to movement conservatism and to evangelicism, in the slot of as his vice president. So he really marks that transition. He himself might have been the old genteel Republican from the East, but he represented the shift to what we have in the present.
Mm-hmm. And to talk about that Willie Horton ad, for our listeners who need a reminder, you know, it was a 30-second television commercial in the heat of the campaign showing Willie Horton, this African-American man with an ominous voice, saying that Willie Horton had been let out of a Massachusetts prison and went on to rape a woman. And it was considered a scare story of an African-American criminal. Tell me the impact of that ad and how it changed politics.
Well, to say it changed the situation is an understatement that at the time, in the summer of 1988, Dukakis and Benson were running almost 20 points ahead of Bush and Quayle. And the Willie Horton ad is what changed the debate entirely. It was an absolute race whistle, and it was designed to be that. I mean, the people that were on Bush's campaign were people like Lee Atwater, who quite deliberately were using the issue of race to try and reorganize America by marshaling race along the side of the Republican Party rather than and turning people against the Democrats.
And Roger Ailes, of course, aided with that. So, you know, we have this assessment that here is this genteel, this diplomatic form of politics that George H.W. Bush embodies. But really, is that true? And also true, is it that he's also what connects the modern form of Republican politics and, like you said, the Rockefeller form of politics from the past?
Well, I actually think David put this very nicely in his obit, and John Meacham has said the same thing, that Bush was willing to do anything it took to get power to go ahead and govern in what he considered to be the mode of an Eisenhower or Rockefeller Republican. He was just hemmed in by the time he got there. What do you think, David?
Well, I think that's so. That Meacham quote is quite interesting about how John explains how the president would do anything to get the power. He would traduce his own values to get power so as to project his own values. Now that's a morally, at best, ambivalent view. We always think of Clinton as the person who puts things in boxes, but the ultimate box keeper was George H.W., who was able to do that. He was able to do that with Clarence Thomas as well, and to still have that sense of gentility. And I think a lot of that sense of gentility came in the post-presidency. We were accustomed to saying that the best post-presidencies were Hoover's and Clinton's. But the one who did the best with his post-presidency may well have been George H.W. Bush, who erased from the American consciousness the fight about Justice Thomas, who erased the Willie Horton by being a gracious host, by inviting people like me and others constantly to Kennebunkport so we could burnish his image, who exuded a certain grace and elegance, even as we were losing any shards of grace and elegance from our civic life. But I'd like to hear what Heather says about this.
Well, you know, I think that's true, but I also think that the point you made initially is so important because we tend to forget that George H.W. Bush oversaw the end of the Cold War. And that, he succeeded in that in part by doing things quietly and by not triumphing. If you imagine a president since then, his son, for example, George W. Bush or President Trump, at that moment, they would not have kept their mouths shut and let things fall apart. And quietly, and it could have been World War III, and even his involvement with the first Iraq War, refusing to permit small countries to be gobbled up by big countries in the wake of that cataclysmic change in world society, solely by doing nothing, in a sense, over big issues, is to me sort of the positive that a president can do by not doing something. But you look at that moment and you think we were very, very lucky to have a man who'd been trained in intelligence and who did have that layer of gentility on him, having the grace to handle it the way he did seems to me to have been almost unique in the era since the rise, if you will, of Richard Nixon.
This is the place where we employ a phrase from another Republican president, Calvin Coolidge, a former governor of Massachusetts, who said, "I never get in trouble for things I don't say."
But even for the things he did say, some of it we have forgotten, like his criticism of the 1964 Civil Rights Act when he was running for Senate in Texas. His abandonment of his longstanding pro-choice politics in order to be chosen as Reagan's running mate. And even during his presidency, you know, his critics said he seemed disconnected from average Americans, that he lacked a true domestic agenda, especially at a time of great economic unrest. But so much of that is not part of the bigger conversation of his legacy. Why do you think so much of that has been overshadowed by this image of an elder statesman that he was able to form, also partially as a result of his humanitarian work under Bill Clinton's presidency?
Well, I think part of it is what came next. And part of it is that you do forget some things. Who talks today about President Nixon's welfare policies or his highway policies? I mean, you do tend to, you know, you do tend to gloss over a lot of things, but it is true that he changed his mind on a lot of things. You know, there should be some room for politicians to take a look at the landscape and to adjust their views. Sometimes it's actually done by conscience. I have no idea on the right to life versus abortion rights thing what motivated the president. I tend to think that it was not necessarily pure, but we don't really know what's in the man's heart.
Do remember that when he is running in 64, that's also when Barry Goldwater is running. So for him to take the positions he did were much more moderate than Goldwater was doing, and he was running better than Goldwater, but he was this movement of the party to the right as it moved south and west, and he's running from Texas and picking that up. I also think when you look at him and his switch to the Right to Life movement from being so firmly pro-choice, it's a mistake to ignore Barbara Bush's effect on his rehabilitation, if you will. Barbara Bush was a woman that many people really, really liked. They liked her outspokenness. They liked her continuing support for women. They liked her support for choice. And that enabled him to kind of burnish up his moderation, his points on the side of the moderates that he couldn't get in his harder stances. And they were a team, and people liked that they were a team, especially in an era when marriages are not necessarily long-lasting or don't necessarily look very good in the public eye. And they really managed to pull that off and support each other. And she helped his image a lot, I think.
So George H.W. Bush, you know, he came to the Republican Party when the party, as we were speaking about earlier, was showing early signs of veering to perhaps zealous and populistic conservatism. Do you think George H.W. Bush, with the Willie Horton ads, with his defense of Clarence Thomas during the Anita Hill hearings, with his switch to pro-life instead of pro-choice and so many other choices, do you think he laid the framework for what is now Donald Trump?
He absolutely paved the way for the rise of the kind of politics that we've seen, not just with Donald Trump, but in the era since him. The Willie Horton ad really legitimized that. If somebody like a Bush, somebody who had been so instrumental in the Eisenhower wing of the party, was willing to kowtow to that part of American life, to that part of American culture, to throw link the whole concept of a government that regulated business and provided a basic social safety net and provided infrastructure, to tar all that as being an attempt to provide special interests for murderers and killers. It signaled that was the direction that the party was going to move, and it's not just Donald Trump who's done it since then. It has gotten more and more extreme on the part of the Republicans. And you wonder what would have happened always in American history, you know, if George H.W. Bush had come out and refused to hire Lee Atwater, had refused to go down that road, had said, we are better than this, I will not support this, I will take a loss in the election, and I will support Dukakis and Benson and work really hard to win next time free and fair and square on American values, if we would be where we are today. And I'm one of these people who believes that the ends never justify the means, and I think we have proof of it right there with that despicable, as Michael Dukakis later called it, Willie Horton ad.
I never understood what affinity George H.W. Bush could possibly have had with Lee Atwater, given Lee Atwater's involvement with the Tom Turner seed campaign and all some of this other kind of stuff. It was a mystery, and I think a moral problem that I don't think he ever reconciled, and that we are ignoring a bit in this period of mourning and reflection.
Well, thank you so much to both of you. That's Boston College History Professor Heather Cox Richardson, author of To Make Men Free, A History of the Republican Party. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And David Shribman, executive editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette and Pulitzer Prize-winning former politics correspondent for the Boston Globe. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, a former substitute teacher on why he thinks discipline can set students free. I'm Maria Garcia. This is Radio Boston.